The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello, good morning to you all. This is Richard Martin on the 30th of January, coming to you with the wake-up call all the way from Singapore. And, well, I think I would like to start by giving you some more lowdown on real estate. People are, of course, jumping on the bandwagon, saying that real estate prices are bottoming out and that there's a high chance they'll start moving up. Absolutely no information, no justification for that comment. And so let me spend a few minutes telling you why that is. Of course, as you would expect, the National Association of Realtors says the real estate trend for 2012 will be one of, quote, continued slow growth, as we saw in 2011. Well, what slow growth could they possibly be talking about? The reality is there is no growth. It's so bad, in fact, that 2011 was the worst year on record for home sales. Yes, that's right. The worst year since records have been kept. A trend, by the way, I warned about back in 2009 when they were talking about those stupid green shoots that were reportedly popping up all over the country. I notice they don't talk about those much anymore. Fewer people bought new homes in December, making 2011 the worst year on sales record, the Commerce Department said Thursday. New home sales fell last month to a seasonally adjusted annual pace of 307,000. The pace is less than half the 700,000 that economists say must be sold in a healthy economy. About 302,000 homes were sold last year. That's less than the 323,000 sold in 2010, making 2011 the worst year on records dating back to 1963. The median sales price for new homes dropped in December to $210,300. Builders continued to slash prices to stay competitive. Still, sales of new homes rose in the final quarter of 2011, supporting other signs of a slow turnaround afoot in the depressed housing market. Millions of homes remain in the shadow inventory. Prices continue to drop, even with interest rates at historic lows. And jobs, the real driver behind the ability to purchase a home, don't seem to be coming back, despite an unemployment rate that is officially on the decline. No matter how bad it gets, however, the corporate media's cheerleaders will continue to try and convince you otherwise. Home builders are now more hopeful because more people are saying they might consider buying this year. And home construction picked up in the final quarter of last year. According to Jennifer H. Lee, senior economist at BMO Capital Markets, quote, although this decline was unexpected, it doesn't change the story that housing is likely bottomed. End of quote. Ian Shepherdson, chief economist at High Frequency Economics, said easier lending requirements historically low mortgage rates, and improved hiring all point to consistent, albeit slow, rises in sales in the coming months. And I quote, "A sustained rise in new home sales is imminent. Home builders say so too, and they should know." End of quote. Well, people maybe say they might consider buying this year, but there's a difference between someone wanting to buy a home and having the ability to do so. Housing, as I have vehemently maintained since the onset of this real estate crisis, is not going to bottom anytime soon. We are looking at a decades-long, perhaps longer, collapse of the U.S. real estate market. Variable mortgage rates are going to continue to adjust upwards for those buyers who took them on in the midst of the boom, which means they will be paying more in monthly payments at the end of this year than they are today, putting even more strain on consumers who are quickly running out of savings and losing purchasing power for essential goods to monetary inflation. On top of that, there are literally millions of homes in shadow inventories, homes that have been foreclosed on, that, for all intents and purposes, aren't even counted as being in existence. Home builders are naturally going to say that a sustained rise in home sales is imminent. Does anyone really expect them to come out and say, "Hey, we've got a great house for you, but it may lose 20% in the next 18 months? They will say whatever they have to say to make a sale. Since the initial meltdown in subprime real estate, the financial pundits, economists, and industry insiders have been telling us things would get better, that we're just about to turn the corner. Ladies and gentlemen, these are the same people who argued that the subprime fiasco was isolated to just that sector of the market. But of course, we now know that the problems were much, much bigger than that. Yet the most influential media outlets, like the Wall Street Journal, who last year penned why 2011 may be the end of the housing crash, continue to ignore, probably by design, what's really going on. Well, going forward, we may see some positive real estate numbers because things don't drop in a straight line. The long-term trend, however, is very negative for home values. To get an idea of just how bad it can get, just look at Japan. From peak to trough, their real estate bubble saw a collapse of 75% over the 10 years following the burst in 1990. They have still not recovered. Not think that the United States is immune to such a collapse. Expect the worst, because there is a strong chance that that is exactly what is coming. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let me give you my information. It is the privilege, my honor, to inform you that there is indeed a toll-free number graciously placed at your convenience by a very wonderful company known as Progressive Radio Network. And the number, in case you are waiting with bated breath, and even if you aren't, is 888-874-4888. Once again, 888-874-4888. And if you would like to write in your questions, please do so. My email address is open throughout the entire show, and the email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, RM@gfawd.com. And finally, my direct line to Singapore via Sarasota, Florida, which marks the end of the line up to which you have to pay, is area code 941-441-1682. Again, my number in Sarasota, to call me directly anytime during the 24-hour period, leave a message and a phone number. If I'm not around, please call 941-441-1682. Right, well, it seems like we had a nice, very successful meet-up group yesterday in New Brunswick. Sue was very happy with the result. I got an email from her this morning. And she says as follows, there were 11 of us, and it was a very lively and informative meeting. Pretty much everyone there has decided to go. Go meaning emigrate. Sarita was there, and she was delightful and really helped to animate the entire group. A few of us remained until almost 7. 5 hours of discussion. How nice. I guess some of you must have got some real quality information out of that. We agreed upon topics for the next 3 meetings. 4 of us have independently chosen the same country. The date and time will remain the same. I really learned a lot from the meeting. Susan. Well, thank you, Susan, very much. I appreciate the information, and thank you, everybody, for going. And please tell your friends, relatives, and colleagues, and make sure that you go at the end of February. I don't have the date yet, but as soon as Susan forwards it to me, I shall forward it to the archives of the show. Okay. Well, quick word about an email which I got last week from somebody who asked me not to talk so much about emigration and stick to the matter in hand, economics. Well, it's actually the first time I've ever got a request not to do something. I've only used the F word once on my show, and that was done with great preparation and requests of the powers that be in PRN, if I may invoke the word, as a quote, of course, something else said, but nevertheless, it had to be done, and I was up to the task, I did it, and I've never looked back. But maybe I'm old, maybe there's other reasons I find it hard to come out with that word, even though I am actually seeing it more and more and more in polite conversation. Maybe I shall just have to look at a mirror and say it 500 times without stopping, and perhaps I shall be of a mind to bring it up in the conversation with company present. We shall see. But fear not, the word shall remain taboo for the time being. Although, listeners, you may use the word with gay abandon as often as you wish. So please call up. I shall not be offended. And provided it's not beeped out, you may do so. Anyway, back to the email. I am going to ignore the email, not ignore in the sense I did answer the email, and I'm in fact addressing it here, so I'm not exactly ignoring it, but I will continue to talk about immigration, ladies and gentlemen, because that is one of my themes. As you know, and we're not going to belabor the point right now, but I feel that the United States in about 5 years' time is going to be absolutely unlivable as a country. And the only people that will really make out, not even those with money, but those with the good sense and the fortitude and the vision to have sought refuge in pastures yon. I will talk about it, and I will give you all the information and encouragement I can. I don't want to belittle the seriousness with which I feel strongly about this subject. It is very close to my heart, and as the days, weeks, and months go by, my impressions are confirmed and reaffirmed. Needless to say, you know me well enough, ladies and gentlemen, if ever I change my mind for any reason, you will be the first to know. So, there we are. And I hope that this will not offend too many people, but that's what the wake-up call is all about. So That's the name of the game. All right, let's have a very close look at the fourth quarter 2.8% GDP figure, which was announced last Friday. Now, I don't usually talk that much about GDP, but this ties in with what I've told you so often about lying statistics and falsifying and misrepresentation. And I couldn't let this pass without comment. So it may be a little turgid in parts, but I want you to try to stay with me on this because it's very important. The GDP, the gross domestic product number, is one of the most important statistics, in fact, the most important statistic that we have to offer you. And therefore, it's essential that you should understand why this figure may not be all it's cracked up to be. You see, that 2.8% number is softer than it looks. Two-thirds of that so-called growth, in other words, 1.9%, was from inventory build-up, and standard accounting practice says that growth in inventory increases GDP, while sales of industry and inventory reduces it. And quoting the newspaper Barron's, I quote, "Rail sales, rail final sales, GDP less inventory changes, expanded at an anemic 0.8% annual pace in the fourth quarter, a sharp slowdown from the third quarter's healthy 3.2% rate. That paints a very different picture from the apparent pickup in headline GDP growth from the third quarter's 1.8% yearly rate. The difference reflects the shift to inventory building in the first quarter from a drawdown in the third quarter." End of quote. Well, I suppose one could spin inventory growth as businesses being optimistic about future sales and building inventory, but given the weaker retail sales of late in comparison to previous years, that is frankly unrealistic. And so all that really happened was a total reversal of inventory sales in the previous quarters. There will be a drawdown of inventories over the next few quarters, which will be a drag on future GDP numbers, much like the pattern we have seen the past few years. But retail sales growth was not strong. And for the last year, 90% plus of total retail sales has come from decreased savings, as the savings rate dropped from 4 to 2%. It'll be hard to go much lower, so the boost we got last year from retail sales accounts for most of the year-over-year growth in GDP. If most of retail sales growth came from reduced savings, that suggests that retail sales will not offer much in the way of growth for the coming year. And I'm just saying, ladies and gentlemen, this is not what you're being told, but that's what I'm telling you, so don't be surprised when you see the GDP down less than expectations for the coming three quarters. And further, when calculating real GDP, one subtracts inflation. The Fed prefers an inflation measure called PCE, or personal consumption expenditures, which is essentially a measure of goods and services targeted towards individuals and consumed by individuals. The number you read in the various media is the CPI, or Consumer Price Index. Now, the CPI is inflexible in that it's always the same basket of goods. PCE, on the other hand, is supposed to take into consideration the notion that, for example, if steak is too costly, we'll eat hamburger. The CPI is typically 0.3 to 0.5% higher than the PCE, which, of course, is convenient if you want the GDP number to look better. The Fed changed PCE in February of 2000. The change was buried in the footnotes of the annual Humphrey Hawkins testimony by then-Fed Chairman Greenspan. So the anemic growth of 1.9% for the last decade would have been even worse if we had used the previous measurement of inflation, CPI. Understand, there is an argument in favor of using PCE, as many academics argue that CPI actually overstates inflation. But there is also an argument to use CPI. It really depends on what you want the final numbers to be. Today, the year-over-year change of CPI was 2.5%, with the PCE only rising 1.7%. And last quarter was down sharply to plus 0.04% on an annual basis. An anomaly of low energy and commodity costs? Well, partially, for sure. So if their target rate of inflation is 2%, using PCE gives the Fed grounds for a looser monetary policy. All in all, GDP was helped by numbers that are not likely to repeat. Last year, at the time, we estimated 4 to 5% growth for 2011. Fell rather sharply short, I'm afraid. Consumer spending on goods surged, but was largely offset as consumer spending on services sagged. The aggregate improvement of 0.21% in consumer spending was accomplished even as real per capita disposable income was flat, indicating that some of that improvement, particularly since it was focused on goods, may simply be retail sales brought forward as a consequence of deep holiday discounting on the part of retailers. The growth rate for private fixed investments dropped by well over 1% to an anemic 0.41% annualized rate. Even as businesses grew their inventories, they were moderating the growth of their capital investments. Governments at all levels contracted their expenditures. State and local governments spent less on both operating expenses and capital improvements. And the flood of fiscal federal spending has clearly dried up. Perhaps the most alarming line item, or perhaps cheering, depending on your point of view, was the minus 7.3% annualized contraction rate in national defense spending. Even given the state of politics in a presidential election year, it's hard to imagine that trend reversing over the next few quarters, especially when ongoing military drawdowns and the inertia of federal budgets are taken into consideration. Imports reverted to historical form, probably as a result of both firming commodity prices and diminishing impacts from the Japanese tsunami. Ladies and gentlemen, all of this, which may be somewhat hard to follow, but all of this tells you there is no reason to expect that part of the GDP equation to do anything but weaken the headline number in the quarters ahead. If the highly positive swing in the inventory number is real, it is certainly not sustainable. And when combined with actual consumer spending, the numbers themselves would be prima facie evidence that manufacturers overcorrected in anticipation of huge holiday spending. Such an overcorrection should lead to reversals in the coming quarters. On the other hand, if the swing is an artifact of firming commodity prices, it's just a further indication that the headline number is hopelessly out of whack, subject to erratic phantom movements as the BEA's deflators struggle to track pricing changes. Despite the improved headline data, there really isn't much meaningful positive information in the latest GDP report. The improvements in consumer spending on goods is probably just a natural form of consumer self-medication to offset the extended frugality fatigue, which was caused by massive retailer discounting during the fourth quarter. The really significant aspect of those sales is that they may have only pulled spending forward from the coming quarter. There has been no improvement in real per capita disposable income that could possibly warrant any increase in consumer spending. And the fourth quarter splurge on goods is almost certainly coming from three things. One, a drawdown in savings. Two, a partially offsetting decrease in spending on services. And three, extra pocket money from lower at pump gasoline prices. At a macro level, those funding sources have been augmented by an enormous expansion of student loans and, for a non-trivial portion of all households, unprecedented rent-free living as a consequence of vastly extended foreclosure proceedings. With the exception of the rent-free and student loan components, for which there simply are no horizons or painless endgames, all of the probable sources for the increased consumer spending will probably revert to historical norms during 2012. And lastly, the volatility of the inventory figures continues to distort the headline number enough to render it useless as a source of genuine economic information. In the best of times, the inventory data provided by the BEA is late and incomplete. Friday's report is disturbing because of how the headline number masks real and troubling weakness in the more substantive details. So again, as always, ladies and gentlemen, I urge you not to believe what you are being told by the government. This playing around with the figures is just another attempt by the government to lie to you and fool you and make you take steps which are manifestly not in your best interest. Stay away, is my advice. Well, again, I urge you to maybe listen to that once again if you're doubtful. It is important information, ladies and gentlemen, and will make you very confident of a weakening economy and an official recession to be declared, in my opinion, in either this first quarter or definitely by the second quarter of this year. And this will have profound effects on your investments, your spending, and everything else to do with your lifestyle. So steel yourselves. It's coming, ladies and gentlemen, not long in coming. And when it does, you will be able to hold your heads high and say, you heard it here first. All right, let's take a couple of emails before the break. First of all, from Tina. We get, hi, Richard. It's an election year, so my question is, don't you think they will manipulate the market with false stats and low interest rates to keep the bubble going so that Obama will get nominated again? Tina. No, Tina, I really don't think it happens like that. You may think I'm naive, but there are too many people who want the opposite of what the administration wants for the administration to get away with much by way of manipulation in terms of the figures. Manipulation, yes, it does go on. I've just given you a long example about manipulation in the GDP figures. But that's not anything to do with getting re-elected particularly. That's to do simply with getting people to buy things they shouldn't be buying, to borrowing money they shouldn't be borrowing, taking steps which they shouldn't be taking, all with a view to trying to save the face of these ridiculous politicians who don't know their head from, you know, there where the sun don't shine. No, Tina, I don't think it's going to happen. It's not going to be manipulated. By the way, markets cannot really be manipulated. It's one thing I've spoken about before on the show, but manipulation is really not a function of any kind of medium or long-term investment. It may work in the short term, but manipulation has never worked in the long term. So there you have it. Another email now from Nathan Privett. Not only Salenti, but Dean Jakobsen, chief economist of Saxo Bank, and Bob Janjua, among others, have been talking about a bank holiday recently. Do you think this is likely? And if so, what are the implications for bank account holders? No, again, I don't think a bank holiday is on the cards in the near future. It may well come if things spin out of control in Europe as a result of some of these defaults, which I see coming imminently. But I don't see it in the short term, and I think we'll have plenty of warning if it does come in the longer term, and that's the point at which, of course, I will encourage you to take your money out of banks. the implications for bank holders obviously are that many banks will go out of business, that those which stay in business may have shortfalls in ready liquidity, and that's why I've always suggested that you have anything from 3 to 6 months money basically at hand just for eventualities. So there we go, ladies and gentlemen. Let's take our break right now, and then we'll come back for more of the same. We are back, and I have an email came in from Al Berry, who says, "Dear Richard, is unemployment worse now or during the Depression?" Well, Al, I am assuming that you are referring to the last Depression as opposed to this one. Good question, and I really think the answer is probably about the same. As you know, John Williams from the statistical company that he runs, which addresses these things, says we are at about 22% overall unemployment if you include everybody. But of course, the government doesn't want to include anybody. They pick and choose which of the unemployed people they wish to put into the mix, which brings us, of course, to 8.5%, which is so ludicrously low a figure that, frankly, I'm surprised that anybody can even read it without falling into helpless fits of laughter, except, of course, it's so serious that no laughter is appropriate at this point. I understand that the Great Depression sported a figure at its worst of about 25%. We're not far from that, and certainly conditions are approaching those of the Depression, and yet I've yet to find anybody in the mainstream or any serious commentator who's prepared to admit that we are already in a depression. But, ladies and gentlemen, this is what you've come to expect, and this is what I draw attention to on the wake-up call, so this should come as no surprise to you. Well, in that vein, everywhere you turn these days, someone is proclaiming that the economy is improving. Obama is endlessly touting the improvement in the economy. The mainstream media is constantly talking about the economic recovery. An increasing number of Americans seem to be buying into this line of thinking. Can you blame them? A new NBC Wall Street Journal poll found that 37% of Americans believe that the economy will improve over the next year, while only 17% of Americans believe that it will get worse. They probably about 10% of those are listening to the wake-up call right now. The Obama administration is engaging in a debt binge unlike anything America has ever seen before, and yet many economic indicators are still in decline. Millions of Americans out there are anticipating some sort of great economic recovery, and I'm afraid they're going to be bitterly disappointed. New home sales in the United States hitting a brand new all-time record low during 2011 doesn't exactly speak volumes in terms of a recovery. The 6 million fewer jobs in America today than before the recession started doesn't help out that line of argument either. The average duration of unemployment in the country is close to an all-time record high. The number of Americans on food stamps increased by 3 million since this time last year, and by more than 14 million since Obama became president. The average age of a vehicle in America is now sitting at an all-time high. 18% of all homes in the state of Florida currently sitting vacant. That number is increasing. The percentage of Americans living in extreme poverty is at an all-time high. Only 23% of American companies plan to hire more employees in 2012. Obama said that the employment situation is getting better. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is manifestly not true. The only way that the federal government can claim that there is an 8.5% unemployment rate is because they've just decided that millions of Americans that have been unemployed for a long time should simply not be considered part of the workforce any longer. If the number of Americans that were considered to be part of the workforce was the same today as it was back in 2007, the official unemployment rate put out by the country, the government, would be up to approximately 11%. The number of long-term unemployment workers in the United States was approximately 2.6 million when Obama became president. And today there are 5.6 million, the highest recorded figure of this generation. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I ask you, which of these statistics indicates an improving economy? And by the way, these are not my views or opinions. This is factual information. But of course, the Pollyannas and the media won't tell you this. They'll just gloss over it or just walk away if you insist. They need you to think things are getting better in order to convince you to go out and buy things. You need to resist. That's all. If the economy is improving, like they say, why are companies around the world getting gloomier about the economic future again, according to an annual survey of global chief executives? Nearly half of bosses interviewed by accounting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers are forecasting that the global economy will decline this year. The number of business leaders that are very confident their firms will grow has also fallen, from 48% to 40%. The confidence of chief executives is decidedly down as they deal with the aftershocks to the recession, according to Dennis Nally, chairman of PwC International, and I quote, "The optimism that had been building cautiously since 2008 has begun to recede," end of quote. The International Monetary Fund cut its forecast for global growth and warned that the European debt crisis threatens to derail the world economy. This is what Olivier Blanchard, the fund's chief economist, had to say at a news conference in Washington, and I quote, "The epicenter of the danger is Europe, but the rest of the world is increasingly affected. There's an even greater danger, namely that the European crisis intensifies. In this case, the world could be plunged into another recession," end of quote. The fund, in an update of its World Economic Outlook report, lowered its estimate for global growth this year to 3.3% from a September forecast of 4%. The expansion next year will be 3.9%, down from 4.5%. The euro area may enter a mild recession in 2012 as it shrinks 0.5%. The U.S. outlook was unchanged at 1.8% growth. These powerful people need to get their story together, or they need to stop lying. Which is it, ladies and gentlemen? You be the judge. Ah. Well, a company called Inner One, which had received a $118 million grant from the Obama administration in 2009, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection on Thursday. It said it had been affected by competition from China and other countries. Inner One is the third company to seek bankruptcy protection after receiving assistance from the Energy Department under the economic stimulus law. California solar panel maker Solyndra Inc. and Beacon Power of Massachusetts energy storage firm declared bankruptcy last year. Solyndra received its $528 million federal loan, while Beacon Power got a $43 million loan guarantee. Could somebody please tell me this? What the hell is the United States government doing, deciding who shall receive taxpayer assistance to survive and who shall not? And can't they even find qualified personnel to make these decisions? What happened to free markets? What happened to free enterprise? What a waste of time. What a criminal, cruel waste of your money, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, yes. Not mine. Not lots of other people's around the world. Your money is at stake. Your money, you know? Well, on the surface, the Fed's decision to keep rates at 300-year lows made the basically any official attempt to relieve the pressure will trigger the collapse. Either way, the whole thing is spun as an effort to help the U.S. stay in its slow grind higher. But in any event, here's a bit more about Greece and the latest outrage. They're now starting just to talk about the fact that the ECB and IMF are trying to maintain all this debt at par, and has the effect of forcing the remainder debtors to take the entire haircut. The European Central Bank has been propping up Spain and Italy recently. The Greek deal is what has spilled the beans to the public. The situation has been out there for months, but no one's mentioned it. You see, the ECB bought a bunch of Greek debt at a discount and now thinks it has the right to sell it at par while the private holders are having their debt haircut. This means that those that sold out to the ECB would have done so at what could now be a profit if the ECB had its way, with the ECB wanting their holdings to be valued at par. Let's see if the ECB could get anywhere near par for what they hold. And by the way, the same is true for the IMF. So if this outrage gets to prevail, which I doubt, the other holders of the bonds of those countries can expect even larger losses for holding on. These Club Med countries are broke. The Greek bailout, or whatever else you want to call it, is a joke. When the dust settles, they expect Greece to have 120% of GDP in debt. They'll be lucky if it's less than 200%, but even 120% is beyond the point of no return. What this means is that though the ECB wants the holdings of the bonds they purchased to be artificially valued at par, the truth is they're not going to be able to sell these bonds at any price. This probably means that in the not too far distant future, we're going to see a run on the euro. The ECB is holding so much junk that it can't sell any of it to mop up the excess. Even the Fed can merely call the dollar loans to European banks to support the dollar without buying a single bond. Worse yet, Hungary has been blowing up for months, but most people didn't hear a peep until a couple of weeks ago. In fact, there are several countries in Europe which are about to blow. When the world realizes that these outfits can't be supported by the international banking thieves without increasing the haircut of the remaining bondholders, there is going to be a panic. And what will follow is bank failures all over Europe. This will start the deflationary ball rolling. Lehman will look like a drop in the ocean by comparison. Well, last night I sent out to my email distribution group an article showing that global temperatures have not moved one iota since 1997, proving my contention that there is no such thing as man-made global warming. And I know how much flack I'm going to get for that, but I'm up for it. I got this reply from Steve Kruger. Loved the article, Richard. I enjoy seeing the lies of government exposed. In my opinion, with the Gulf Stream Atlantic conveyor nearly stopped, Northern Europe is in for a little ice age similar to the 1750s. Also in 2007, we sold our home and we could have moved to a higher elevation, but the government was touting a 200-foot rise in sea level. Considering their track record and their unique ability to get almost everything wrong, we moved 1,000 feet from the ocean. Needless to say, our feet are still dry. Global warm this, Al Gore. I also enjoy the slaps you take at peak oil. When you consider the trillions of barrels of oil used in the last 150 years and the trillions that remain in the ground, We are asked to not question that oil comes from the extinction of the dinosaurs. Richard, to make that much oil, I would think the Earth would have to have been covered with dead dinosaurs 1,000 miles deep. If we were told that oil was in fact renewable, the next question that the public would have is, why is it so expensive? Steve Kruger. Oh, thank you, Steve. Man after my own heart. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, if any of you would like a copy or to the information about that article, which is quite conclusive in my opinion, but again, I'm sure there will be people who find a way to argue with it, showing that, frankly, global temperatures haven't moved one iota since 1997. It comes complete with a chart showing you the facts, but there are people who will argue with the facts, too, as they have done since time immemorial. So I will throw up my hands in despair. If you would like a copy, please email me, and I will definitely send it to you. Those of you who do follow my email, my emails have already received it, and, well, you'll know that already because you're on the computer right now, aren't you, listening to this show. So anyway, just to remind you, my email address is rm@gfawd.com. RM for Richard Martin and GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Then just give me an email and I will make sure you get the link. All right. Well, let's talk about, well, I got a, yes, I did. I got an email back about my peak oil contention. Which came from BP, by the way. You've got to be kidding. BP, oh, okay, I'll believe them. Here's some data for you. And then I get a link. Pay particular attention to the peak in discoveries. If you've done your research, you'd see that U.S. oil production peaked in 1970. That Prudhoe Bay production peaked in the late 80s and is in steep decline along with Cantarell in Mexico. Discoveries peaked in the mid-1960s for the planet and in the early 1930s for the U.S. The peak in discoveries always precedes the peak in production. These shale oil reserves are a joke and don't come anywhere near the reserves discovered in Alaska, for example. It's not that oil is running out, but production rates are declining. Granted, the demand destruction of the last several years has put peak oil on the back burner. As Nicole Foss at the Automatic Earth says, you basically want to deal with what's going to kill you on Monday as compared to what might kill you on Thursday. She's one of the few people who understands the relationship between energy, the environment, and economics, along with Chris Martinson of The Crash Course. Right now, the stuff you talk about, the expiration of the latest debt-based currency system, is the most imminent threat we face right now. In reality, you haven't done your research, and judging from your recent podcast, you simply refuse to. Jerry Irwin, retired U.S. Army intelligence officer and preparedness consultant, he sent me several charts which show the decline in current oil fields production, notably Cantarell in Mexico, with which I have no quarrel. I just don't think it's possible to extrapolate the future from current field drawdowns. That's all. But I'm very glad to be able to bring you an alternative viewpoint. I only wish the same could be said for my opinions concerning the economy in general. You know, ladies and gentlemen, there must be somebody out there who disagrees with what I say. You know, it is very important for me to hear your disagreements, because the only real way in which I can be sure of my opinion is to hear the contrary opinion and then measure the strength of my own opinions against opposing ones. And that's actually what I do all day. It's not easy. I mean, you know, when I'm doing my research, I obviously have my plethora of sites that I follow, which gives me the information that I need, both for me and, more importantly, to bring to you. But, you know, nothing beats the to and fro of argument and counter-argument. And quite frankly, I have to tell you, that really doesn't happen that often. And I really wish it did, because I would be very happy to be able to discuss things with you. And sometimes, you know, I have been known to be wrong. And when I'm wrong, I will, if I think I'm wrong, I will definitely be the first to admit it. But the thing is that the truth is I follow so many people, infinitely more alert and basically clued into what's going on than myself, that frankly I don't really need to worry about being wrong. I just need to be able, frankly, to bring the information that I have for you to your attention. And that is what I will do as often as I can and with as much, basically as much enthusiasm as I can muster. Well, in the U.S., the government now requires all citizens to have a passport in order to pass the border, even when driving into Mexico or Canada. And as you probably know, obtaining a passport is neither free nor guaranteed. You must apply, pay an ever-increasing fee, and wait for weeks to be approved and receive it. Recently, the State Department quietly proposed a new biographical questionnaire in lieu of the traditional passport application. The new form requires you to provide things like names, birthplaces, and birth dates of your extended family members, your mother's place of employment at the time of your birth, whether or not your mother received prenatal or postnatal care, the address of your mother's physician, and dates of appointments, the address of every place you have ever lived in your entire life, the name and address of every school you have ever attended. Well, most people would find it impossible to provide such information, and yet the form requires that the responses, quote, are true and correct under penalty of imprisonment. Naturally, the privacy statement on the application also acknowledges that the responses can be shared with other departments in the government, including our old friend, Homeland Security. If this proposal passes, then U.S. citizens will have a nearly insurmountable hurdle to obtain a passport and be able to leave the country at will. Even if it doesn't pass, a clear demonstration of what the people who run the country are thinking. What I've said to you all along, ladies and gentlemen, you need to get yourself a passport, even if you think you have absolutely no intention of leaving the country. You need to get that passport, and I urge you to do that. Write off to the nearest agency, fill in the form, get the passport, and then you've got it nearby. I cannot tell you to what extent I feel there is danger in the air. And those of you who were at the meet-up call on Sunday, yesterday, will have no doubt taken heed of some of the things that we talk about. And if there really are people among you who spent 5 hours discussing this, who stayed from 2 o'clock in the afternoon till 7 o'clock in the evening, it means that this is a subject closer to people's hearts than may be apparent, ladies and gentlemen. I urge you to at least call Sue and find out if you could talk to some of the people that were there at the meeting. Sue herself will be glad to talk to you, will be glad to give you whatever information she can, and of course invite you to the next meeting, which, as I say, I do not have yet, but hopefully I will have by the time the next wake-up call comes. Thank you so much, Noel Thomas. I get a nice email saying, thank you, Richard, for the global warming link and for your vital information. Well, one does one's best, as they always say, and shall not shrink from the task. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the time has approached. And the end of the show is nigh, so please do feel free to tune in again on Friday at the same time, same place, and I will be back hopefully with more useful information from you. And please also remember to stay tuned after the show for Johnny Miller and the Expat Files. And meanwhile, I would like to leave you with another rendition of a fun song from our friend Merle Haggard. So until next Friday, have a good week. See you then.
Hi, everybody. My name is Merle Haggard. I'm joined tonight by Mr. Bretton Wood, my partner. We have a song for you tonight called Inflation or Deflation. It was really well received at a concert we gave last year at the IMF.
As we go through this recession, as farther down we slip, will our central bank get traction soon, or will it lose its grip? It's a mini Great Depression. Our markets went berserk. The Fed is printing trillions now, but will their efforts work? Inflation or deflation, tell me if you can. We become Zimbabwe, or will we be Japan? Credit markets came undone and still are in distress. Will the dollars in my mattress buy much more next year or less? It's a desperate situation when you're at the zero bound. If a tree falls in a forest, is it making any sound? New money makes inflation if folks who have it spend. But if it only sits there, then the misery will not end. Inflation or deflation, the choice is looking grim. I wonder what John Maynard Keynes would say if we ask him. Inflation or deflation, tell me if you can. Will we become Zimbabwe, or will we be Japan?